This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The editor of the New York Times Book Review, in previewing a review this past weekend, wrote that every once in a while a book comes along that changes the national conversation. The book she was referring to was Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City by Matthew Desmond.
Desmond chronicles the experiences of eight families living in poverty in Milwaukee, in places like a trailer park on the south side and in rundown apartments on the north side. The Arizona native started his academic work on housing as a grad student at UW-Madison. He's continued in his professional work at Harvard University, and it's work that last fall earned him a MacArthur Genius Grant.
But the book is far more than an academic exploration of poverty and eviction in Milwaukee. It's an intimate portrait of the people wrapped up in it, from tenants to landlords. Desmond will be in Milwaukee today for the book's publication date. We reached him in Massachusetts, though. Matt Desmond, it's a great pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to talk.
Thanks for having me.
So you make the point that sociologists and others studying poverty have for a long time kind of treated the poor like they are walled off from everyone else. How does that show itself, and what has it kept us from understanding?
I think it shows itself in studies and books about poor neighborhoods or groups of poor people, you know, single moms or folks involved in gangs, for example. And I've learned a lot from those books, and that's a wonderfully rich tradition. But they've always left me with a sense of there's something missing, you know, and what's missing from them is kind of a relationship, you know, kind of a these kind of bonds between poor folks and non-poor folks that are really central to creating and maintaining inequality today. And I think the inequality debate that we're having in this country mostly focuses on the middle class and the rich. But the poor are left out of it. So I wanted to try to write a book that was about poverty, but wasn't just about a poor community or poor people. And that's why I started looking into eviction, because I knew it would allow me to write about tenants and landlords and judges and a lot of people that are bound together in this process.
Well, and so why is eviction such an important part of the picture?
One of the reasons is that it's just so prevalent. It's just so common. And if you read books from the 1930s or 1940s, you're left with a really clear impression that evictions used to be rare. They used to draw crowds. I remember talking to the gentleman and Eagle Movers in Milwaukee, one of the big moving companies that does evictions. And they said when their dad started it, you know, it was just kind of one truck. And if he needed a hand or two, he'd pick up a guy from the rescue mission. But now, you know, Eagle Movers has expanded and is a pretty significant business with big moving trucks and full-time crews. And I think that represents a larger trend in America today where eviction is really coursing through our city. So in Milwaukee, about 1 in 8 renters experiences some kind of eviction over the course of 2 years. You know, that's a formal eviction that goes to the court, or an informal eviction that doesn't, is when a landlord just forces a family out beyond the purview of the court, or when a landlord loses their home to foreclosure. You know, 1 in 8 renters in Milwaukee every 2 years, that's incredible to me.
Well, and, you know, and I haven't really gone looking, but I gather there really has not been a lot that's been written extensively about this dynamic.
That's right. I was really surprised at that, too. And when I started this work, I spent time in Milwaukee neighborhoods following families that were evicted and following landlords that were doing the evicting as well. And so I went looking for studies that would answer really basic questions, you know, like how common is eviction? What are the long-term consequences? Who gets evicted? And I was surprised to find very little work on it. You know, eviction had been overlooked in a very large and rich body of research on urban poverty in the city. And so that's what spurred me to start collecting statistical data myself to kind of get a sense of how big this problem was and who's most affected by it.
Well, and if that's what spurred you to do this, I gather you had kind of an emotional connection to the issue of housing for a long time, going back to your childhood or at least your undergraduate days in Arizona?
I think so. You know, I think that I'd always been really troubled by the amount of poverty in America today. And I think homelessness especially was something that spoke to me. And I was involved in Habitat for Humanity as an undergraduate, spent a lot of time with homeless folks around my college, and just kind of did connect with that issue and kind of from the ground level in those days. Yeah.
Well, and so you were at UW-Madison, and evictions were on your radar screen. There was a catalyst, though, that really sort of led you to move into this trailer park on Milwaukee's south side. What happened then?
So I moved to Milwaukee, and I said, well, where do I see evictions? You know, where do I go? And I opened the newspaper one day, and there was a story about a trailer park that might be facing a mass eviction because the city had accused it of having an excessive amount of housing problems and a lot of police calls. And so, like any good ethnographer, I went down there and rented a trailer that day and asked to move in. And that didn't happen. The landlord and the city worked out an agreement, but it was still a really good place just to look at the business of owning property in poor neighborhoods and to meet people that were going through everyday normal evictions caused by not being able to keep up with the rent.
Right. If there weren't mass evictions going on, there were certainly a lot of individual evictions happening.
Yes. And I think that many of us today still think that low-income Americans typically live in public housing or benefit from some sort of housing assistance from the government. But the opposite is true. I think it's really important to recognize that the vast majority of low-income families live unassisted in the private market. And for those families, paying the rent has become a huge challenge. So today in America, about 50% of poor renting households pay at least 50% of their income to housing costs, and about 1 in 4 of those households pay at least 70% of their income to pay rent and keep the lights on. So under those conditions, eviction has become a really common experience in poor neighborhoods.
So is that ratio you describe really the key catalyst in starting people into this cycle of evictions, or are there other circumstances as well?
Under the conditions of, you know, what sociologists call extreme rent burden, you know, if you're paying 60, 70, even 80% of your income to rent, a very small deviation can cause you to become evicted. So I'm thinking, for example, of a woman I met in Milwaukee that I call Arlene in the book. She was a single mom. She was raising 2 boys. And then she had to pay 88% of her income to rent a pretty rundown apartment on the north side of Milwaukee. And she was confronted with situations like, should I pay my rent or should I feed my kids as much food as they need? Should I pay my rent or should I pitch in a little bit for some funeral costs when my sister passes away? And, you know, these conditions are presenting low-income families with terrible choices. And I think that at base, we can't fix, you know, the eviction epidemic in our countries and poverty more generally if we don't address housing, if we don't address this problem of unaffordability.
Well, right. And you spent a great deal of time with a couple of landlords. You mentioned the people that owned and managed the trailer park. And also there's a woman you call Sharina Tarver. And their place in this whole dynamic is really pretty complex. And it was at times hard to know how to feel about where they fall.
I think that means I did my job. And, you know, because it is complex and it's not easy. It's not simple to just kind of dismiss either tenants or landlords as being at fault. You know, I think that when you really get down and look at the problem for yourself, it becomes very complex. And landlords are major players in poor neighborhoods. They're the ones that literally own poor neighborhoods. And I think that we know things about police officers and teachers, social workers, but we've overlooked, you know, how important landlords really are to things that are central to our cities, things like racial segregation, things like poverty, things like residential instability. Landlords are a really big part of that story.
Well, and I think it'll surprise readers to learn how profitable these poorest parts of the city can turn out to be.
That surprised me. When I started this work, I was really curious about why someone would buy and manage property in some of the poorest neighborhoods in the city. But after I crunched the numbers and looked at the profit margins of the landlords that I was spending time with, I wondered why you wouldn't, you know? The profit margins were not modest for the landlords that I spent time with. And they weren't modest not in spite of the kinds of neighborhoods that they were operating in, but because of them. So the thing that makes owning a property in a very poor neighborhood risky, you know, low property values, makes renting property in that neighborhood potentially lucrative. So you can buy property sometimes outright with cash. You have very low mortgage payments, if you have any at all, because the assessments are low, so are your property taxes. And you have lower expectations about maintenance as well. And so I think that there's a business model at the bottom of the market, and that business model can cash out.
Well, and what ends up happening, at least in the experience that you portray in this book, is that quite often the tenants come in for really not a lot of money, but rapidly an issue surrounding maintenance happens. Often they withhold rent, expecting maintenance to be done, and at the same time the landlord can use that withholding of rent to kick them out and bring on the next tenant.
I think this is a really important point. And this is a point about the difference between laws on the books and laws in action. And tenants who are giving almost everything they have to pay the rent, they activate their rights under really scary conditions. You know, if you're paying 70 or 80% of your income to rent, you're going to have to ask your landlord for a favor one day. You know, you're going to have to seek his compassion. And sometimes tenants move in from day one and they're behind because they can't pay, you know, first month's rent, last month's rent, and the security deposit. And there's a deal that's struck between landlords and tenants in those situations sometimes. The deal is the tenant gets a home and the landlord gets a skimp on maintenance costs because the city can't report that landlord without increasing his risk of eviction. It's illegal to retaliate against a tenant that reports a landlord for housing code violations. But it's not illegal to evict a tenant just for being behind at any time. And so this means that in a real sense, those rights, they cost money. And they are rights for tenants who are sure that they can pay their rent every month and won't ever have to ask for a favor.
There is an anecdote that we sometimes hear, especially as politicians talk about poverty, and that's, you know, the single mother who uses her food stamps to buy lobster or prime rib. And it's one of those stories, you know, that gets thrown around to make the claim that poor people could be better off, but they squander their money. And you actually tell the story of Lorraine, who uses her food stamps at one point to buy lobster tail and lemon meringue pie. What do you think we should take from her story?
Yeah, I think that, you know, my job is to write about the issues of poverty and all their complexity and not shy away from things that that are hard to explain. And I think that we should make it clear that this is a one instance in the book. You know, Lorraine doesn't do this on a regular basis, but it was a special occasion. She was celebrating an anniversary of her and her boyfriend who had died a few years before I met her. And she did. She took her entire monthly allotment of food stamps and she went to the store and bought lobster and king crab legs and had a meal by herself to remember him. And it wasn't because she her benefit or food stamps was too much for her, you know, luxurious. I mean, that really cost her. She went hungry for the rest of the month. She had to go to food pantries. And when Lorraine told me she did this, I was confused. I was a bit angry at her. But I really wanted to try to understand it. And what I came to understand was that, you know, we usually think, or some people think, that the poor are poor because they make bad decisions. And the book certainly doesn't shy away from the decisions folks are making on the ground. But I think in Lorraine's case, you know, she's making bad decisions because she is poor. You know, if she scrimped and saved and kind of, you know, pinched every penny, she wouldn't really be in a different position than she is today. You know, the difference between where Lorraine lives, her state of poverty, and even just stable poverty or a poverty that gives you a shot at, you know, middle class living, that distance is vast. And so if you're Lorraine, you know, you kind of pepper the suffering with color. You know, you might do something once in a while to enjoy life, and that's going to cost you. But you do that because not doing that and doing that doesn't really have an effect on your economic future. And so Lorraine didn't apologize for those kind of things, and I don't think I should either. I think I should write about them and try to help people understand them as best I could.
And at the same time, as an observer to these conditions, it must have been kind of repeatedly heartbreaking to see things that could have gone right or better anyway fall apart repeatedly.
What was heartbreaking was seeing the depths and expanse of our poverty. And what was heartbreaking was seeing, you know, mothers not being able to feed their kids at the end of the month. And it was heartbreaking seeing children's toys piled up in the snow after an eviction. It was heartbreaking seeing someone like Arlene call 50, 60, 70, 80 landlords, you know, and hearing them all reject her application. You know, it's incredible the depth and the pain that we allow in this rich land. But there was also other scenes, too. You know, there were scenes of generosity and spunk and resistance. You know, I'll never forget this this one moment where I was spending time with two women who I call Crystal and Vanetta in the book, and they were homeless. They were at a McDonald's eating some lunch, and this boy walks in. And he was probably 8 or 9. He was dirty clothes. His face was swollen, looked like someone had hit him. And he didn't go up in order. He started going around to the tables and looking for scraps, you know, looking for scraps of food. And Crystal kind of elbowed Vanetta and said, you know, hey, what you got? And they pulled their change that they had in their pockets. And they went up to the boy and bought him dinner, you know, gave him a hug and sent him on his way. Now, these are two homeless women. And it just reminded me powerfully of how they refused to be reduced to their hardships. Vanetta would call it heart, having heart.
It seems significant that you chose not to write this book in the first person, but how did you see your participation as ethnographer as part of the story?
Early on, I made a decision to get out of the way of the story. I wanted people to interface with the folks that I had met in Milwaukee as closely as the reader could, you know, to see it. And I thought that writing in the first person would cause a bit of distance from that. And so you're right, I removed myself from the story. I think that I've always seen ethnography or in-depth reporting as this extremely powerful window into everyday life and the ability to capture everyday life in its full humanity, or as much as you can, as much as you're able to. So I think that ethnography allows us to bear witness to the human cost of the lack of affordable housing in our cities today. It allows us to see the deep and jagged scar evictions is having on the next generation, on the kids and their instability and the blunting of their opportunity. And I think it allows us to see, you know, the ironies and inconsistencies of how certain policies play out on the ground level.
It's also, I think, significant that not only do you not write in first person, but, I mean, it struck me that with very few exceptions, we don't hear from official sources in explaining the nature of this dynamic. It's really the people that are telling the story by what happens to them and how they respond.
Yeah, I think that's where the story is. You know, I think that's where it is. And I think that if we really want to understand the meaning of poverty, the causes of it, and especially the texture of it, you know, the hardships of it, we have to go to the people. You know, we have to see it from shoulder height. But, you know, the book also marshals a lot of data that's statistical, that's historical, that's based on, you know, interviewing thousands of renters in Milwaukee, analyzing hundreds of thousands of eviction records to kind of tell a story that also is broader and bigger and kind of moves from narrative to larger picture and then back to narrative again.
Well, so you're right that there is one pretty basic and not all that complex public policy solution that could be a huge help in interrupting the cycle of evictions. Talk about the role that housing voucher programs could be playing.
So just to simplify what vouchers do, if you have a housing voucher, instead of paying 60, 70, 80% of your income to rent, you pay 30%. And you can take that voucher, and as long as your housing isn't too big or expensive or too shabby and run down, you can live wherever you like. We know that housing vouchers make a big difference in the lives of people that have them. You know, we know, for example, that after years and years on the waiting list, one of the first things that families do when they get their voucher is they go to the grocery store. You know, they buy more food. We know that their kids become less anemic and stronger. But Arlene's kids, Vanetta's kids, most kids, poor renting families, aren't so lucky, and they don't get enough to eat because the rent eats first. And so what if we took this program that's already working and expanded it, made it something that every family below a certain income level could benefit from? That would make a huge dent in the problem. It would change the face of poverty in America. It would significantly reduce family homelessness. Evictions could become rare occurrences again. Families could be stable in their communities. They could plant roots, invest in their neighborhoods, allow their children to finish schools in one school. Workers could keep working instead of being kind of destabilized and pulled from their jobs after losing their home. I mean, it can make a massive difference. And it's clearly within our capabilities as a nation. But I think it depends on how we answer a simple question, which is, do we think housing is a right in this country? Do we think that what it means to be an American is to have access to decent, stable, affordable housing? And I think we have to answer yes, because without stable housing, everything else falls apart.
You and is it your wife have started a project called Just Shelter?
Yes. So one really encouraging thing is, you know, city after city, all around the country, there are organizations working on these issues. You know, there are organizations working on keeping families in their home, preserving affordable rental housing, and really trying to reduce family homelessness. And we started an organization called Just Shelter, and you can go visit it at justshelter.org, and you can get introduced to these organizations. And there's a map that you can click on. So if you're in Milwaukee or Madison or Omaha, Nebraska, for that matter, or Anchorage, Alaska, you can see the organizations in your community working hard on these issues and get plugged in. So that's one thing that website does. And another thing it does is broadcast eviction stories. It collects eviction stories from all around the country to kind of show the human face of this problem and the lasting imprint the lack of affordable housing is having on families and in our communities.
Well, the book has already gotten a lot of attention. As we're talking, it is mostly reviewers and journalists who have read it. In an ideal world, when someone who does not have a radio show or a review column or a blog reads this book, when you talk about getting plugged into the issue, what do you hope it spurs in people?
You know, I want people to remember, you know, Lorraine, you know, this grandmother in a trailer park who has to choose between paying the rent or keeping her gas on, you know, or facing a bitter Milwaukee winter without heat. I want them to remember, you know, mothers like Vanetta, who, while homeless, you know, arranged an Easter egg hunt in the Salvation Army homeless shelter in downtown Milwaukee to give her children some light and some inspiration in this really dark time. I want them to remember people like Arlene, who are just trying to keep afloat, just trying to keep her kids fed and off the street, but are confronting just being crushed by the high cost of housing. And I think that those stories left an impact on me, and I'd hope they'd leave an impact on readers too, and drive home the point that eviction is not just a condition of poverty, it's a cause of it. It's making things worse in our cities, that we could do something about this problem, and that if we want to confront poverty in the United States, we have to fix the housing situation. You know, we can't fix poverty without fixing housing.
With all the time you spent in Milwaukee and all the experiences you experienced and chronicled, do you have any sense for what it's going to feel like to be back in Milwaukee with this book completed and the work not finished, but certainly at a different stage than it was when you lived here?
I really miss Milwaukee. I just miss the feel of it. And I miss my friends in the city. And I'm just really looking forward to being back. The people that are in the book have read the book, and they read the book months ago, you know, while it was still in manuscript form. And we've been carrying these stories with us for a long time now, you know, and I'm just really excited to be back, to give Arlene a hug, to catch up with Scott, just to meet the folks that are in the book and share this moment with them. I think that's the thing that I'm most looking forward to.
Well, Matt Desmond, it is a really remarkable book, and I use that in the best sense of the word. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Matt Desmond's latest book is called Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. The book comes out today, and Desmond will talk about it at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee this evening.
Desmond lives in Boston. He did his graduate work at UW-Madison, during which he created a project called the Milwaukee Area Renter Survey.
We do have one editorial note as well. If you tuned in this morning to hear our interview on Milwaukee Magazine's article on millennials and Milwaukee real estate, we thought it best to move that interview to tomorrow.
Stay tuned. We'll meet a Milwaukee researcher who is exploring the link between chemicals found in hand soaps and the problem of antibiotic resistance. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.